Welcome to Battery Park City's Irish Hunger Memorial. I'm Adrian Flannelly, a New York immigrant from Attymouth, County Mayo in Ireland, from whence this memorial, a gift from the Slack family, was transported stone by stone to this site and dedicated in 2002. I have asked Brian Toll, New York artist and creator of this memorial, to explain and take us on a walkthrough.
As a visitor approaches the Irish Hunger Memorial, they may take note of the paving stones on the ground beneath their feet. It was important to me that people are able to engage with history on many, many levels. And so even as they step on the pavement en route to the entrance of the memorial, they're actually making contact with history. If they look carefully, they'll see black stones with white fossils from the ancient Irish seabed from Kilkenny. It's some of the oldest limestone in the world, dating to 300 million years ago. Well, as you get closer to the memorial, you find yourself beneath a cantilever nearly 30 feet extended from the base of the memorial. That cantilever represents, in my opinion, the weight of history bearing down on the visitor as they approach. Now, between those bands of stone, there's text. 2 miles of text, not a word of it, is carved into the monument. It appears in the form of shadow. It's shadow cast on glass. And that was a very, very important breakthrough for me because it did two things. It gave the text a kind of ghostly quality to it. But it also gave us the flexibility and the freedom to move and change text as we saw fit. By including the audio component of the memorial in the passage, I wanted there to be an ongoing dialogue between the memorial, artists, writers, poets, musicians, and the public, one that was dynamic, one that could be updated over time. The memorial honors those who perished in the Great Irish Famine, but it also acknowledges this very dire situation as it continues through human history. One of the most direct ways of doing that is through sound, is through information, is through communication. The goal was that in the event that famine were to arise in a location somewhere in the world, that the public could have information that explained to them where that was happening and why that was happening. That, I think, is best achieved through sound.
Knowledge brings responsibility for action. In 1984, the rock musician turned famine relief organizer and humanitarian Bob Geldof responded by gathering world-famous musicians in a group called Band Aid and launched the Live Aid concert to highlight world hunger and poverty.
The passage itself is reminiscent of passage tombs in ancient Ireland, court cairns, passage places that entered into burial chambers that were illuminated from above with skylights. In this case, the burial chamber is not a tomb space, but a domestic space. That is a resited, relocated famine-era house. As we move through the house, we enter into a larger chamber. And that larger chamber would have been built after the events of 1847, when there was some relief coming into Ireland. A lot of people ask the question of the rooflessness of the house. There's an old Irish proverb that says, when the fire goes out, the thatch falls in. And of course, from a practical standpoint, that makes perfect sense. The house is maintained, it's kept warm, and the thatch stays dry. But metaphorically speaking, if the house is not maintained because of hunger or weakness, the fire can't be maintained, and the roof might in fact fall in. The house is very typical of those found in Ireland, built in the early days of the 18th and 19th century. Oftentimes those houses consisted of one room. The fireplace was really more like a firewall. the fire might have been built directly against the wall, and the smoke would rise up through the room and seep out through the thatch. Many of these houses didn't have proper chimney flues.
As we step outside the Irish Famine Cottage, Brian Toll describes the creative design of the field, the plants, and the flora.
Much of the land, if not most of the land, was owned by British landlords, absentee landlords, who subleased properties to tenant farmers. It's not uncommon, or wasn't uncommon, for a farmer and his family to occupy lands smaller than a half or a quarter of an acre. That's pretty much the minimum amount of land necessary to sustain a typical family. We're talking about the bare minimum. So if you think about places like Achill Island and how rocky and rugged and windy those shores are, farmers attempted to create a cultivatable land by piling kelp and seaweed up on the rocks and creating compost and planting potatoes and other vegetables into those new soils. So those regions, those far western regions, were very, very vulnerable to the elements. And when one major crop, in this case the potato, failed, it created a chain reaction that rippled throughout the entire country. There are 62 indigenous plants on the memorial, and they were all very, very carefully selected and arranged to represent a rural landscape. A landscape like many of those on the western coast of Ireland, where families once thrived and were lost or displaced as a result of the famine. It's very important that in this memorial, the plant material of the landscape is maintained, cared for, preserved in the state that I originally intended it to be. You know, oftentimes if you go into a park in New York City, there are seasonal plantings. You know, the tulips come up in the springtime or the roses come up in the summertime, and there's this kind of rotation of plant material that's ornamental. This is not ornamental. This is fundamental to a rural landscape. What you see there is unhybridized plants in their natural state, expressing themselves at different times of year, negotiating among themselves. You know, some plants, of course, flourish here. Others have a more difficult time. And so there's this negotiation of the landscape. The dozen or so different grasses and the blackthorn, which has great symbolic historical value. The potato ridges or drills, if you've ever traveled to Ireland, one experiences or sees these drills. And for the American tourist or the American visitor to Ireland, it seems counterintuitive that these ridges are running with the hill. But in Ireland, there's so much rain, there's so much water, that the drills are arranged perpendicular to the hillside, so the maximum amount of water actually can drain from the hillside in order to allow for the potatoes, which are now raised up in these drills, to grow and be healthy.
There are 32 counties in Ireland. Each county contributed an authentic stone to this memorial.
It was important that the stones were not exceptional, that they were typical of the region that they came from. It was also important that they weren't the largest stone, or that the stones weren't so small that they couldn't be seen. And so it was important that I establish a sort of range of how large the stones ought to be. I arrange them along the pathway so that visitors can see them and touch them easily. I wanted that to be a more random experience where people can actually discover it. The memorial is not a miniature Ireland. It is a fragment of a landscape.
In conjunction with this memorial, New York State released a human rights curriculum which includes, alongside its existing subjects of North American slave trade and the European Holocaust, the Great Irish Famine. Students will develop a better understanding of the factors which contribute to famine in today's world, and will, as a result, become actively concerned about the human right to adequate nourishment. The lessons of the Great Irish Hunger have a claim on our fundamental humanity. They remind us that we have an opportunity to help our neighbors who face similar suffering.